So as we look at these stories then, I want you to hold in mind the fact that there are two psalms that were written around the time of the events that we are going to be looking at. Psalm 34, and we'll sing that psalm at the end of today, and Psalm 59. And what we have in Samuel, we have the events, what happens, and then in the Psalms, we have David's reflections. We have David's understanding of God and how God is at work even in these desperate moments that we read of here. So I won't read Psalm 34 with you. I won't read Psalm 59. Maybe you'll have a chance to do that on your own in the week. And then I guess the task is to marry the Psalms with these passages in 1 Samuel. So let's take a look at this first story there. And we've got David arriving at the city of Nob. And it sure seems that the ark was kept, that the priests were, the sacrifices were made, that the temple, as it was, the tabernacle, I guess, was there, the altar, and all the paraphernalia of the temple worship. So you can see then, Bruce, when David arrives at Nob, and there is Ahimelech, the priest. And straight away you see that Ahimelech was afraid when David arrived. And Ahimelech said to him, "Why have you come? And why have you come alone?" Now what we need to try and get is the sense of fear that there is not just for David, but in society as a whole. Saul was a tyrant, and everyone was fearful. And I guess it's a bit today like Russia. We've had the end of the election there, haven't we? And you have the sense of people in the street are fearful. People maybe are forgetting how to think critically of their leadership. There's a sense then of society and the threat. And that's what's going on here. So this guy, Ahimelech, he would have known who David is. He would have known about Goliath. He would have known about the tensions between Saul and David. And so his first response is one of dread and fear. And he is afraid of Saul. Not afraid of David. He's afraid of Saul. So he puts this question to him in verse 1. Why are you alone and no one is with you? And what we need to be very clear about is David lies. And when you look at David, it's very interesting to see someone who will lie. And if we get time tonight, the stories that we have in this chapter, you see David pretending to be mad. David will commit adultery. David is responsible for murder. David is responsible for great pride. He will, at the end of his life, carry out an opinion poll, a census, if you like, in Israel. David, again and again, is someone who sins and fails. So this guy who'd be brave and courageous in battling Goliath, here he is lying. And he's lying because he's desperate. And what's interesting to note, I mean, you know I don't usually look at my notes, I don't know why I have them here really, but what's interesting to note is when you read the story there is no judgment passed on David by the scriptures themselves. So whoever writes on Samuel doesn't tell you that David is wrong. He doesn't invite you to judge David. It's simply a description of David lying. And he's lying in order to save his team, to survive, so that Saul doesn't catch him and kill him. And as a pastor, I've known people over the years lie. I've known Christians tell lies. I've known Christians when they feel very desperate, when they feel themselves to be hemmed in and with no chance to lie. I've known Christians lie because of things that have gone on in their workplace, when they've made a mistake, And they lied to me and tell me that they lied to their employers. So what we need to do is suspend our judgments. We are not here, it's not our business to look down on David and judge him for telling a lie. We just simply note that that is what he does. So look at the line there that David comes up with. The king has ordered me on some secret mission. So the English isn't very well capturing the Hebrew. It's a secret mission. And I've had to come to see you. I've left my companions in a secret reclusion. And I come to you to get some food. And I want food for myself. And I need food for the men. So there's the lie that David tells. And he says, the king, King Saul, has sworn me to secrecy. So if I meet anyone, meeting you today then, I am not to tell you what is the purpose of my mission, why I've been commanded to come. I'm just asking you for food. So you get that sense when you're in verse 2. And the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, don't let anyone know anything about the business on which I'm sending you or what I have commanded you. So there's your lie. And then in verse 3, David says to Ahimelech, will you give me something to eat? So the first thing to notice about David's condition is that he's hungry. And it is probably not just hungry, he may well be starved. So he's fleeing for his life, he's telling lies, and he's starving. And he comes and he asks in verse 3 for 5 loaves of bread. And he said, in my hand. So what he's saying there is that I have to eat or I'll pass out. Give me food now, otherwise it's too late. So there's desperation, urgency in David's action. Whatever you can give me, feed me, he says, in verse 3. So you get a sense of how long it must have been that David's been on the run. And he's arrived at north to see the priest. So the priest then answers in verse 4. And he says to David, well, look, I've got no ordinary bread to give you. All I have is holy bread. Now, let's not go into the details too much. I've never been somebody who loves the detail of the Old Testament priests and the sacrifices. Some of you do, that's fine. Doesn't float my boat for me. But what David is being told here is all they have is the bread that was placed on the altar and dedicated to God. So it's holy bread. So you can see now what verse 4 is telling us. There's no common bread on hand. There's holy bread. And then this priest, Ahimelech, he falls for the lie. And he said, well, as long as you or your men have not had sex for 3 days, then you may be able, possibly, to have this holy bread. And then verse 5, David says, truly, and it's irony, you're meant to kind of have a secret spy. David's lying. So when he says, truly, honestly, I swear that we've not had sex for 3 days, well, there's nobody there, is there? So he's maintaining this lie that he's on a secret mission. So truly, verse 5, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I left on this mission. Well, it's far longer than 3 days. But he's maintaining the illusion. The vessel of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, says David, even though it was consecrated in the vessel today. Now, David is very sneaky there. He's also very clever. David is showing his understanding of the rituals. So every 7 days, I think, I may be wrong, look at that for yourself. Fresh bread would be made, put on the altar, and the bread that would be there for those 7 days, maybe, that bread would be put to one side. So David knows this. So he's asking for the old bread, that's cold stuff, the bit of a moldy stuff, maybe, that had been on the altar for 7 days. He's made some new today. So put the new on the altar, give me the old. That's what he's asking Ahimelech to do. So you can see there, verse 5, The bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated today. So the priest gave him, so here's Ahimelech, giving him the holy bread. But there was no bread, other bread, common bread, but only the show bread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. So there's David eating. And I want to stress, because we've got this Sunday school bit, haven't we, of David and the Old Testament. David is starving. And you get the sense in the Hebrew that he's had to talk to a little bit there, when he just wants to eat. All he wants to do is eat. So as he eats, you see the next act in the story. Verse 7. A certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg. He was an Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. So I want you to imagine the scene. There's David starving, persuaded Ahimelech to give him something to eat, and he's eating. And then, you know what it is in films? The camera pans away. And what happens at verse 7 is the camera turns there, and you see this man Doeg. And you see him watching. He's watching them. And what we know as the audience is that this man is Saul's spy. And he shouldn't really be there. He was meant to have come and gone before David had arrived. But for reasons we don't know, Doeg is being detained. So he's still there at North in the Holy Place. And he's watching David, and he recognizes it, and he sees him eat. And all the while, Doeg is saying, right, I'm going to tell Saul. I'm going to hot foot from this place as soon as I can to let Saul know where David is, because I just see him for myself. So you can imagine Doeg, and perhaps we shouldn't, it's a bit unfair. You can imagine Doeg with this sort of secret smile and this malicious look on his face as he thinks, right, I can carry favor with Saul. I can be in his good books. I'll let Saul go where his great enemy is. And the camera then just picks him up there, and then it comes back to David, and we have the next bit of the story. So verse 8 then. David then turns to Ahimelech and he says, isn't there a spear here? Or a sword, because I went in such a rush that I didn't bring any sword or any of my weapons with me. The king's business was so urgent that I had to leave in a hurry. Now, more lies. And what Ahimelech then says to him is this in verse 9. All we have here is the sword of Goliath, the Philistine who you killed in the valley of Elah. And imagine again, if you will, Ahimelech goes, look, there it is, wrapped in cloth, and it's behind the priestly ephod, the priestly outfit that he would have worn on certain occasions. If you take that, if that will do, he says, take it. For we have no other except that sword here. And so David then says, there is none like it, give it to me. So he's been given the bread, and he's given Goliath's sword. And so what you need to think about, and only think about it, you may get answers, you may not. Did David go to Nob with the intention of having Goliath's sword? Because the sword was on display in the most holy place for everyone to see the great deliverance that God had achieved by the hand of David. So all this, is it some desperate act of David to get that sword that meant so much to him, through which he was able to finish Goliath off? Did he go for that purpose? And so all of this is some sort of elaborate scheme to get that sword and to take it. Now, I'm going to go through these different stories, and then we'll think about the lessons to learn, where we find God in all this. Because what you see next, so verses 1 to 10, then, it's all one story. David up north, Ahimelech getting the bread, getting the sword. Okay, that's your story number one. Look at what happens next, verse 10. So then David arose, and he fled after from before Saul, and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Now, what's strange about that, guys? Where's he going? What's this kingdom that he's going to? Who is he? And of course, it's the king of Gath. Now, hold that thought in mind. Verse 11. The servants of Achish said, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him?" To one another, they danced, saying, "Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s. David has gone to the very place where Goliath is from. And he's gone there with the sword of Goliath in his hand. Now, what would drive David to take such action that he flees from Saul into the very territory of the enemy? It's almost something that you would say is mad." Well, follow the story. Verse 12, David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior in front of them. He pretended to be mad in their hands. He scratched the doors of the gate. He let his saliva dribble down into his beard, and he presents himself at this very picture of madness before the king of this country where Goliath was from. And so the king comes along and he sees David, and he's dribbling and he's drooling. And, you know, how honest should we be over? Because that phrase that says that he let his saliva fall down on his beard, it also has a sense that he was incontinent. So here's this man, this regular man, and he's thinking. And the king comes along and he says to his servants, look at the man. He's insane. Why have you brought him to me? Do I have any need for madmen that you have brought this fellow, the madman, into my presence? Shall this fellow be of service in my house? So, why does he go in? Why do you pretend madness? And the king takes one look at David, and he sees this man who's no threat, this man who might have killed Goliath, but look at him now. Look at the state of it. Look at what he's become. Just send him away. And so he sent on his journey. That's story number two. And then we finish off with story number three. So chapter 22 and verse 1. David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house learned of it, they came down there themselves. And so everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented, they came to David. And so he became the leader of this group. And there were about 400 men with him. So imagine David as the leader of a gang of criminals, debtors, people whose lives were ruined for one reason or another. People who had lost everything. They were desperate men. And they got to hear about David, and how Saul doesn't know. Well, we'll see that again. They come and they get this group of broken and destitute and outsiders. People that nobody else wanted, with no other hope. People who'd given up on life. They come and they find David, and they become part of this gang, if you like, over which David is in charge. And then you hear this, don't you, verse 3. David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and mother come here with you, till I know what God will do for them. So he's left, like the cave, the men, these desperate chaps, they're in the cave, and David goes on this solitary journey to Moab, and he meets the king. And he says to the king, let my father and mother come here with you. Let them have safety with you, till I know what God will do for them. So he brought his parents before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him there, so they lived in Moab all the time that David was, and the actual phrase is fleeing. So all the time that David was on the way. And then a prophet called Gad said to David, don't stay here in this stronghold, depart and go to the land of Judah. So David went to the forest of Hebron. So that's the three stories. Okay, so it's a man who's going deeper and deeper as he flees from Saul, becoming more and more desperate, resorting to more and more extreme measures. But what he remembers to do is to take care of his parents. Saul would have taken out his anger on David's parents because he couldn't find David himself. So you know, don't you, every time Saul talked about David, it was the son of Jesse. So Jesse was in the sights of Saul. And so, as desperate as David was, he finds a way of keeping mom and dad safe. And he brings them to the kingdom of Moab, and the king agrees. Now then, two things. Why does the king of Moab agree? And all you good New Testament, all you good Old Testament scholars should be able to work out, why does the king of Moab agree? What's your thoughts? Speak up, because we're on Zoom. Any thoughts? Why the king of Moab agrees? What would the king of Moab know? What would he have been aware of? What was, or who was, David's great-grandmother? Who was she? Where was she from? Moab. So David has Moab blood in his veins. David's parents would have Moab blood in their veins. And so that story of Ruth and Naomi, that is the background for why the king of Moab offers refuge to David's family. And so it links in to what we were saying this morning. The whole of the plan of God is worked out step by step by step. So why does David have Moab ancestry? So that because of it, in his time of desperation, he can find refuge in Moab. So going all the way back to Ruth and Naomi then, God worked that out. He worked out the famine in Israel that led them to flee into Moab. So Naomi leaves, doesn't she? She goes into Moab. Then the boys marry, and she brings Ruth back. Even then, God was working out this plan so that then, a few generations later, the king, after God's own heart, would be offered sanctuary, and his parents offered refuge in the king of Moab. So you're meant to read that bit, and you find God in the planning and the working out of his purposes, stretching back generations to ensure the safety of David's family. So there's your first way of finding God. It takes you back to Naomi and to Ruth the Moabitess. When you see David coming before the king of Moab, and you see it in verse 3, please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me. He's doing that thing that we looked at a few weeks ago. What's the great doctrine? Will gave us a word for it. David looks in the same that night. What's David doing? He comes before the king, and he's doing what? For the sake of his parents. What's the word? He's interceding. He's speaking actively to the great king for his parents in their need and in their desperation. So you see David then making intercession for his family. And of course, what David is a type of Christ. And Christ is our high priest who makes intercession for us. He pleads for us at the right hand of God in heaven, pleading with us when, according to our needs. David interceding with the King of Moab is a picture of how Jesus Christ will come and how he will intercede for his people in our needs. So we've seen this before. We've seen David interceding previously and humans again. And just for completeness sake, David in Hume, in his intercession in verse 3 before the great king, he points back to whom? Who made intercession before the great king for his family, that they might be given the space in the land?
Joseph.
So Joseph then, during the famine in Israel, intercedes with Pharaoh, down comes Jacob, and he comes and settles in the land of Goshen. That's part of the background here. It's that knowledge that David would have had about Joseph interceding that would have maybe helped him make this decision. So just looking at that final bit with Moab and the king, you can see at least three things. You can see Ruth and Naomi in the background, David had Moabite blood. You can see David interceding as a type of Christ, and there is this reference to Joseph and his act of intercession for the sake of his family. So there is this third story there, with these details in. We don't know, verse 5, who this prophet Gad is. We don't know if he's linked to Samuel, no idea. But he suddenly appears on the scene, and he's warning David to leave and hide in the forest. And then maybe next Sunday night, we pick up verse 6, and we're back to Saul. And Saul hears about David, and he's in Gibeon, and it's this awful chapter we had a sneaky look at. It's Doeg, his spy, who tells David, where David is. So that's how we can look at look for God in story number 3. Are there one or two things that we can still say? Well, I'd say this to you. With David then, attracting all these sad and broken men, how does he point to Christ? What does he do? How can you find Christ there? And I would suggest two ways. You'll probably find more ways in which David is a type of Christian. And I would see it like this. You remember in Mark, I think, in chapter 12. Mark, and it's really Peter, isn't it, the apostle who writes the gospel. He says, doesn't he, about Jesus, the common people cheered him gladly. And there's a sense here in that of these common, ordinary, broken men, how they are drawn to him and they seek him out. And he welcomes them and he's going to support them and he's going to look after them and he's going to provide for them. And you see as the story unfolds how the number of these men remain stable and David leads them and they fight together, they live together, they worship together. So there's this sense of David is a man recognized by the common man, the ordinary person who's drawn to him. And I guess, at least to me it seems, that there's an echo there of Jesus, the common people hear him gladly. But there's another, isn't there? There's a wonderful verse in Matthew that you love, I know, that we've looked at many times. And every time I looked at it, and I was thinking about this in a week, every time we look at it, I feel that I don't understand. And I tried to understand it, and I tried and tried and tried to understand it. But to my own satisfaction, I feel as if I've never really understood those verses. So think of these men, and I said to you, they're broken. They're drawn to David. Whether it's his history, whether it's his godliness, who knows? but they drowned. And it speaks to me about that verse in Matthew 11. Do you know it? Matthew 11, 28. Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And when you follow this theme in these chapters, David brings rest to these men. They build a city together. Their wives come along. Their children come along. And David gives them rest. And that's how you see David and his men pointing to Jesus Christ. The rest that Christ gives to those who labor and are heavy laden. And that's a foreshadowing of that in the story of these men. Well, I have to bring an eye on the time. What I want to say then, I guess, and there's much more to be said, there's a lot to be said about the King of Gath and David pretending to be mad. I'll leave that with you. I'll just want to know one more thing with you, and that's this bread that David eats, the short bread or the common bread. And do you remember in the Gospel when it's a Sabbath day and Jesus is leading his disciples through the fields and they pluck, don't they? They pluck the corn and they wrap it in their hands and they eat the corn. And then they're criticized for doing so. You've broken the Sabbath rules, say those self-righteous Pharisees. Jesus refers to this event in the life of David and he says to them, didn't even David eat the shoulder when he was hungry and in need? And what you see then in David eating that, again, prefigures Christ as he leads his disciples through the cornfields. And what I would say to you is this, corn or wheat, whatever it was. What I would say is this, when you read those about those disciples walking that day through the fields and they plucked the corn or whatever it was, I've always imagined that to be a little bit like what we might do on a walk in the country. You just pluck something, you know? Perhaps you pluck a bit of grass or you take a leaf off a tree and you're just amusing yourself as you go on a walk. And that's all it is. It's nothing more than that. You're enjoying the countryside. And so, you know, there's a leaf taken and you hold it for a while. But it's not that. Jesus referring to David in his hunger is actually telling us about his hunger and the hunger of his disciples when they walked through that field on that day. It was the desperation of the 12 and Jesus that led to them eating on that day. And it was a Sabbath day. He went against every instinct that they had to do what they did. But they had to do it because they were hungry. And so you see in Jesus and his disciples the hunger and the desperation and the need that you had here in David all those centuries earlier. So what I've taken from that is don't read the Gospels either and think that it was just a casual thing that they plucked those things as they strode merrily along. Just remember for the disciples too and Jesus himself that it was a matter of hunger, that it was a matter of need. And he, in his need, Jesus, the man of sorrows, identifying with us. So to end then, the story of Ahinoam with Ahimelech, the story of David then, going to Moab, protecting his family, those two stories wrap that section around because they're stories of how in our desperation, God provides. And God has provided David with bread and sword. He provides David's family with a home. God provides even in the moments when our need is greatest and we might feel ourselves desperate with no idea where to turn and what to do. They are stories of God's protection of his people, protecting David, and then through David, protecting his family. God protected Christ until the right moment, and through Christ, God protects us. So think of them as protection stories, and in the middle, slap on, is the story of David's madness. How does that fit then? Let's think about that a bit. Get a bit of attention.